Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We're hearing our arguments this morning on zoom.gov. It is April 8th, 2021. Marshall, will you call the first case?
Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Jessen, Judge Smith, Judge Flory, the Honorable Lucinda Jessen presiding. Before the court is case A20-0762, State of Minnesota versus Chase Michael Schwindemann.
Thank you. And just to remind everyone, the same basic rules apply as if we were in our physical courtroom. Each side will get 15 minutes for our argument, and counsel for appellant, you'll have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. If you run into any technical problems, which sometimes still happens, let us know. We'll stop the clock, which you'll see in a corner, and get it fixed because we really do want to hear from you both this morning. So with that, counsel, whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. Are you able to hear me okay? Wonderful. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Jenna Yauk Erickson. I am an assistant state public defender, and I represent the appellant in this matter, Mr. Chase Schwindemann. I'd like to begin this morning by hopefully providing some clarity, because appellant and respondent have rather discordant approaches to this appeal. At this juncture, we have one point of agreement. I agree that this jury was instructed to determine whether Chase Schwindemann committed malicious punishment on January 2nd. I agree, therefore, this court can focus its sufficiency analysis on the evidence from January 2nd. So the question before this court is whether the state provided sufficient evidence to satisfy every element of the crime of malicious punishment on January 2nd.
So if I may, just to be clear then, your argument about the unanimity, sorry, I always struggle with this word, your jury instruction argument, you're agreeing then that is not no longer before us and we should just focus on sufficiency.
So good question, Your Honor. Assuming that this court agrees with both parties and sort of confines its sufficiency review to the evidence from January 2nd, I would also agree that because there's only one act at issue, there are not multiple acts that allegedly occurred on January 2nd, there could be no plainly erroneous jury instruction, or the failure to give the unanimity instruction was not erroneous because we're not talking about multiple acts. If this court were to consider multiple acts, were to look outside January 2nd, then the unanimity instruction would still be at play, if that makes sense.
Thank you for the clarification.
No problem. I would like to focus on the sufficiency issue this morning, and time permitting, I hope to explain to this court three reasons it should reverse Mr. Schwindemann's conviction for lack of sufficient evidence, and also explain three points of disagreement between the parties. We're working with the circumstantial evidence standard. We all know what that is. This court determines what the circumstances proved are, and from those circumstances looks at all the possible inferences. What we know about the morning of January 2nd is that Mr. Schwindemann took the child Elijah out of his crib. He placed Elijah on the plywood floor. Mr. Schwindemann turned away from Elijah to feed his cats. After doing so, he heard a thud. He turned back toward Elijah and saw him face down on the floor. The real question at the core of this case is why Elijah lost consciousness. And the first reason this court should reverse Mr. Schwindemann's conviction is because the circumstances proved support a rational inference consistent with innocence, namely that Elijah lost consciousness due to his condition, due to his rare congenital duodenal webbing that prevented food from passing from his stomach to his intestine. That caused his loss of consciousness, not any external stimulus.
Also, can you point in the record where there would be any expert testimony from medical personnel that would support that theory?
Absolutely, Your Honor. That's the testimony of Dr. Emily Kevin. I'm happy to get the pages of the transcript for you. She was a witness called by the defense. She testified at pages 731 to 763. So Dr. Kevin is actually the doctor who found the defect. She diagnosed it. She also did Elijah's surgery. And she's a specialist in gastroenterology, I believe. She testified that this condition is extremely rare. The opening between his stomach and his intestine is the size of a pin. So no solid food could get through. He actually had pieces of solid food in his stomach at the time he was in the hospital. This caused vomiting. It caused rather significant weight loss. And it leads, we know the condition generally leads to malnutrition.
So yeah, and I saw all that, but where does it lead to losing consciousness? How does a doctor address that?
Certainly, Your Honor. So that is an inference that this court can make from the circumstances proved.
But if it's not consistent with the verdict, it's not a circumstance proved.
So Dr. Kevin's testimony is in the circumstances proved because it's not inconsistent with the verdict. When we sort through the circumstances, or this court, when this court sorts through the circumstances proved, determines what are circumstances proved, it discards facts that are inconsistent with the verdict. Cases like State v. Stein, which is 776 Northwest 2nd 709, contains a really helpful discussion of how to do this process, and that what we leave for the jury, what we trust juries to do, is resolved factual disputes, resolved conflicts. So what we don't have in this case is a war of the experts. This is not a case where the state called an expert who said he didn't have this condition, this couldn't have possibly caused him to lose consciousness, and then the defense called a contrary expert. That didn't happen. To be clear, the state didn't dispute at any point that Elijah had this condition, didn't dispute the doctor's testimony at all. So it doesn't conflict with the verdict. A jury could conclude a child had this condition, a child had any sort of medical condition, and could still be maliciously punished, no question.
Counsel, may I ask, I don't understand really the basis for drawing an inference that that condition leads to a neurological event any more than I would think someone would draw an inference from it that it leads to bruising or to broken bones or to anything. You know, I don't really understand the inference other than conjecture based on a description of the condition.
Certainly, Your Honor. So I have two responses. One is that I believe it's using your common sense to understand what, so this child is starving. He's not getting enough food. The doctor says even liquid has a difficult time passing through. We know he's lost a huge amount of weight. So I think we've all probably experienced in our lives folks who suffer from medical conditions, hypoglycemia, who pass out, who lose consciousness. Normally those people are hungry. That's in our common experience. But the other thing I'd like to note, Your Honor, is that to get to the child's loss of consciousness, to understand the cause, you have to draw an inference either way. There's also nothing in the record to suggest any other cause of this loss of consciousness directly. No one testifies he lost consciousness because of X. No one.
What about the fact that the baby, after the fall, when he lost consciousness, his eyes are rolled back, he's unresponsive, but his lip was bleeding. And we have a history with the appellant of, at one point, I think, you know, he admitted that he, whether you call it hit, tapped, whatever, touched the baby on the lip hard enough to have the lip bleed before, and that happened again. Why isn't that sufficient evidence of malicious punishment?
Certainly, Your Honor. I would say two things. We don't know that Mr. Schwendeman hit Elijah's lip on the morning of January 2nd, right, which is the relevant time period. So the alternative hypothesis in the record from the circumstances proved is that he lost consciousness, he fell on his face, and he hit his lip. So he didn't catch himself. He what Mr. Schwendeman says consistently throughout, and this is also in a circumstances proved, the state elicits this from numerous witnesses, is that he turned around and the child is face down on the floor, right? So we can understand how, particularly if you have a pre-existing lip injury, which we know Elijah did, which may or may not have been caused by Mr. Schwendeman. So the reasonable alternative inference of that one sort of fact is that it could have happened from a blow. There's no evidence that it did, but it also could have happened from him falling. So that alone would not, if you disagree and you think there's a reasonable inference of guilt from that evidence, which I don't agree, but there's also a reasonable inference of innocence, which is the condition caused him to lose consciousness. He fell, not catching himself with his hands, so he hit his face on a plywood floor, sort of reopening his lip injury. The second reason that this court should reverse Mr. Schwendemann's conviction is the state failed to prove that Mr. Schwendemann committed malicious punishment on January 2nd. So this case is unusual for a number of reasons. And one of them is that among the inferences available to this court from the circumstances proved, I would submit that the inference of guilt is the weaker by far. Now, certainly you don't have to pick one or the other. The question before this court is there any inference of innocence? And if there is, of course you must reverse. But I think it's significant to note, particularly the language in respondent's brief lays this quite bare. At page 15, respondent says, quote, the state could not identify what specific acts were committed against Elijah that morning. Could not identify is synonymous with did not prove. There is no evidence in this record that Mr. Schwendemann touched Elijah at the time he lost consciousness, much less which the state, it was, here's what the state is trying to convince this court, hit him so hard that either the blow, which we've never specified how or where it happened, caused the loss of consciousness, or caused him to hit the floor so hard he lost consciousness, but yet left no external signs. That this has never been made explicit by the state, but that seems to be their theory. Again, at page 20 in respondent's sufficiency response, sort of the strongest argument the state makes is that perhaps Mr. Schwendemann hit him on the mouth or ear. We are now on appeal testing the evidence, and that's the closest the state has ever come to explaining what evidence they have of malicious punishment is perhaps. I would suggest to this court that that explains quite clearly the lack of sufficient evidence. The third reason that this court should reverse Mr. Schwendemann's conviction, and these are all, of course, significantly interrelated, is that whatever the state proved, whatever evidence there is, whatever circumstances proved there are about January 2nd, they do not satisfy the elements. So it's, of course, this court's duty to look to all the elements of the crime and determine that they were all satisfied beyond a reasonable doubt, and they were not. It's difficult without the state naming an act, without any evidence of what the supposed force looked like. I would say it's impossible to determine that that act was punishment or discipline, that it was excessive under the circumstances, and that it caused the very specific injury required by the statute. So the statute under which Mr. Schwendemann is charged requires as an element injury to, quote, the head, eyes, neck, or multiple bruises to the body that had to be caused on January 2nd by Mr. Schwendemann. Again, the state has never suggested, because there is no evidence of it, what sort of conduct would have caused that very specific injury. For those three reasons, I would suggest this court must reverse Mr. Schwendemann's conviction. I think it's also perhaps helpful to this court to sort of analyze a few points of disagreement between appellant and respondent. The most important is that the state very early in this case developed a faulty assumption about the order of events in what happened on January 2nd. So we know Elijah presented to the hospital with neurological symptoms. Dr. Hudson, both his testimony and his notes, which are at Exhibit 37, explain quite clearly that what they're looking at is a altered consciousness or a change in the level of consciousness that is unexplained. So he says multiple times that it's unexplained. We're trying to figure it out. Everyone seemed to agree, and indeed I agree. An 11-month-old child just fallen on his own doesn't knock him out. Mr. Schwendemann never suggested that, and certainly we would agree. So the question then was, well, what happened? The state very early on made the faulty assumption that he fell and then lost consciousness, that the fall is what made him lose consciousness, so we had to figure out why he fell. I would suggest that puts the order incorrectly. And indeed, on these circumstances proved, it's far more reasonable that he lost consciousness and then fell. So the real-
May I ask you to explain, I'm not sure what you mean by early on developing a theory. Are you saying that they said that the evidence that the state introduced is that the losing consciousness preceded the fall? I'm not sure what you mean by this theory of why it matters to a sufficiency claim.
Sure. I merely think it's helpful when we're thinking about how to think about this, how to frame it in our minds, to think about the loss of consciousness happening first. That fits more neatly with the evidence, with the circumstances proved, and it demonstrates why there is this reasonable alternative hypothesis of innocence, that his condition caused him to lose consciousness, fall on his face without catching himself, and the neurological symptoms thereafter were sort of the remnants of this loss of consciousness. I think it's harder to understand what happened if you assume he fell, the fall caused him to lose consciousness, and we have to figure out why he fell. Again, because what that implies is that either Mr. Schwendemann hit him so hard, the blow caused him to lose consciousness, or the contact with the floor did, but somehow left no external signs. I would suggest that that's less plausible, less likely on the circumstances proved. I see that my time has expired. Thank you very much.
I have one additional question,
if sure.
I may.
Of course.
And this goes back to something you noted in your original brief. So maybe kind of as the parties have looked more closely at the arguments, this is an issue, but you talked about kind of the lip bleeding, that wasn't, and your view didn't meet the element of the causing bodily injury to the head. Any more you can tell us about that? Because I must say, just logically, I think lips are on your head.
I can, Your Honor. I'll try to give you my brief answer, and then we can always discuss it again during my rebuttal. I would agree with you, except for the rest of the language of that provision. So if it merely said head and neck, I would think any part of your head counts, but it doesn't. It says eyes, and I think your eyes are on your head. And if the statute chose to use language that specifies one part of your head and isolates it for inclusion in that list, I think the failure to include other parts of your head on that list suggests they're not in the list. So I think we could all agree that a concussion is a head injury. A subdural hematoma is a head injury. But I don't think a broken nose under that statutory definition is a head injury. I think it's a nose injury. I think the legislature could have said nose, could have said mouth, teeth, ears, but they didn't.
Any other questions from the panel? Thank you.
Thank
you. Mr. Magnuson, we'll turn to you.
May it please the court, counsel. Good morning. My name is Peter Magnuson. I'm an assistant attorney general, and I represent the respondent state of Minnesota. And I'm assuming everyone can hear me. Great. Addressing the first argument from respondent that the circumstances proved support another inference that EK's injuries were the result of the duodenal webbing. That is clearly outside of the circumstantial evidence standard of review. As this court noted in State v. Stewart, it's 923 Northwest 2nd, 668. It's a decision from 2019, and I'm reading from page 674. Thus, when a jury is presented with conflicting medical testimony about the nature of injuries and their possible causes, we assume the jury believed the expert testimony that is most consistent with its verdict. The expert testimony here was from Dr. Mark Hudson, who testified that based on the number of injuries suffered by EK and the location of the injuries, he testified definitively that his symptoms, the neurological event, was the result of domestic abuse, domestic trauma. So there was evidence in the record, medical evidence in the record presented that supports it. The defense expert's testimony is contrary to that and is disbelieved.
If I may, is that enough? Isn't that a fundamental question before us to say domestic trauma? I believe that was the right phrase. But when we look at the elements of malicious punishment, we start with an intentional act. Doesn't the state have to say, here's the intentional act?
No, No, that's, if that was the case, the state would never be able to successfully prosecute cases like this, where the victim is simply too young to come in and relay to an investigator or later relay to a court exactly what happened. This court, in fact, in Stewart, it's very similar facts, and now I'm reading from page 675. The remaining hypotheses are few and implausible. It is unreasonable to infer that BGD caused the injuries himself by banging his head on the floor, because Dr. Swenson explained, and we assume the jury believed, that was physically impossible. Later on, the court said, the only reasonable inference from the circumstances proved is that Stewart intentionally inflicted great bodily harm upon BGD. Now, in that one, I think the explanation from the, there was no direct evidence as to what happened. And that's where the circumstantial evidence test comes in. We give the jury all the evidence, and part of that evidence is that when he went to bed, EK was fine. During the course of the night, EK was fine. Only after he got up and was with appellant and in appellant's exclusive custody and control at the time, all of a sudden he goes to the point where he is limp, non-responsive, his eyes are rolling back in his head, and according to EK's mother, on the way to the hospital, he had a seizure. The nurse at the local hospital testified that based on her experience and training, those neurological symptoms could not be explained by a kid, an infant of that age, simply falling to the floor. Dr. Hudson testified the exact same way. There is no other explanation for it. So is there direct evidence of an injury? Certainly there is. There is the split lip, and it's fresh. There was fresh blood on EK's lip. And Dr. Hudson also testified that there was an undiscovered injury, a torn frenulum inside EK's lip, which he testified was an extremely rare injury that he expects to see no more than one time a year. So yes, there is evidence of an injury to EK's head on the morning of. If there had to be some kind of direct evidence as to how he suffered that injury, then we wouldn't need the circumstantial evidence test.
Okay, so maybe we could turn, if we could, Mr. Magnuson, kind of then turn to the issue of kind of, is there an alternative, an inference of innocence given this diagnosis? I mean, and it does strike me that one question is, for a child that's gone from what, 70% of expected weight to 20%, you know, and has this condition, and reading through Dr., I've got it here, it's Dr. Kevin's testimony about that the child lost consciousness because it didn't have enough to eat, that's something that could have happened between when he went to bed that night and woke up in the morning, given this condition and the dramatic weight loss. Why couldn't that be a reasonable inference of innocence?
Because it was presented to the jury and necessarily rejected by the jury. If the jury believed that testimony, the jury would have found appellant not guilty. Obviously,
but counsel, I'm sorry, I'm trying to understand that, because as I understood at least our discussion of the testimony, Dr. Kevin didn't testify to the cause of the neurological event, testified instead to the medical condition the child had, and that's not in dispute, is it? There's not conflicting testimony or rejection of the duodenal issue that the child has, right? Well, we're talking about the inference, what the inference is from that accepted diagnosis or not disputed diagnosis, right?
But the argument was presented to the jury that the neurological event was prompted by the medical condition, the pre-existing medical condition. Of course, there's no evidence that had ever happened to EK before. No one has ever provided any information when EK's mother and appellant gave their medical history to the nurse at the local hospital, as well as to Dr. Hudson at Children's Hospital. There's no mention of this ever happening before. So even if it is part, it's not a reasonable inference given the testimony of Dr. Hudson about the number of injuries and the location of those injuries, which indicated to him that there was ongoing abuse of EK here. So there is not another reasonable inference that can be drawn from these facts and from these circumstances proved other than the appellant caused it. Now, if this court is going to go back and retry it, then if essentially this court is stepping into the shoes of the jury, which is, as the court knows, that's improper for this court to do on appeal. You accept the decision made by the jury and you take as true the evidence that supports it, and you take as disbelieved any evidence that does not support it. So it's not a reasonable inference based on Dr. Hudson's testimony and the testimony of the RN. Taken in their totality of the circumstances, the evidence doesn't leave another reasonable inference. And this is an unpublished opinion, so I know it doesn't carry any precedential weight, but I would cite it to the court for this issue. It's State v. Murray, M-U-R-R-A. The court file number is A16-2053, and the Westlaw site is 2017 WL6567651. It's an unpublished decision from December 26th of 2017. And this is at star six. In light of the circumstances proved, one inference is that Murray caused CM's bodily injuries by a means other than bouncing the baby on his knee, such as by shaking the baby violently. This is a reasonable inference in light of the medical evidence about the nature of CM's injuries, the evidence that other causes are impossible or implausible, the evidence that CM's injuries were sustained shortly before he arrived at the emergency room, the evidence that CM was uninjured only 2 hours before he arrived at the emergency room, and the evidence that Murray was the only other person with CM before the symptoms appeared. So this court has, on remarkably similar facts, upheld a circumstantial evidence conviction based on circumstantial evidence. And I'd suggest to the court that that analysis, while not precedential, is persuasive and can be followed by this court here.
Mr. Magnuson, if you would, I wanted to follow up with you about my questions and responses regarding whether the injury, looking at the bleeding lip, whether lips are on one's head, looking at the statutory interpretation of the malicious punishment elements. I think you, what, could you share your perspective with us on that?
The statute provides under 609.377 subdivision 1, a parent, legal guardian, or caretaker who by an intentional act or a series of intentional acts with respect to a child evidences unreasonable force. So the evidence here indicates that EK lost consciousness, became limp, his eyes rolled back into his head. According to his mother, he had a seizure on the way to the hospital. When he got to the hospital, he could make eye contact with the RN, but was otherwise non-responsive. In fact, I think the RN noted that when she was trying to start an IV, EK did not fuss at all, despite being jabbed with a needle on multiple occasions. So based on the neurological event that everyone assumes must have happened, that can only have been caused by unreasonable force, since everyone agrees that EK could not have inflicted that level of force upon himself to cause those neurological symptoms. So the only other person that was available that could have was the appellant.
So we don't have to reach that issue because clearly a neurological event occurred. No one's disputing that, and that would be involve the head. Is that what you're saying? In short,
yes. And it could have been, it could have been shaken. It could have, there could have been something else. He, appellant could have backhanded EK, and he could have fallen. He could have shoved him into something. You know, there's this. That's the problem. We don't know what happened, but we do know what the aftermath is, and there's no explanation of it other than someone applied unreasonable force to EK's head. And the only one in the room at the time that could have applied that unreasonable force was appellant. If there are no other questions, I would simply ask the court to affirm the jury's finding of guilt.
Other questions from the panel? Okay. We'll return to you for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Hopefully my 5 minutes will allow me enough time to talk about Dr. Kevin's testimony, Dr. Hudson's testimony, the split lip, and head injuries. Respondent is absolutely wrong that there's conflicting medical evidence in this case. Dr. Hudson's testimony does not touch on Dr. Kevin's, does not conflict with it. The state at no point disagreed that Elijah has this condition. In fact, what I think is really important to remember is at the time the nurse and Dr. Hudson are treating Elijah, they have no idea he has this condition, no idea. And they're not asked at all in their testimony about this condition, how it could have affected him, whether it could have caused him to lose consciousness. But the most important thing is that there's no conflict. There's not an expert who says he didn't have this condition. There's not an expert who says the condition could not have caused a loss of consciousness. What that means is Dr. Kevin's testimony is in the circumstances proved. This is not a war of experts case. There's no conflict. The jury could have believed he had the condition and still found Mr. Schwendeman guilty of malicious punishment. You can maliciously punish a child who has a condition, who is ill. Those two things can coexist. Because they can coexist, we can't say the jury rejected that testimony. They are circumstances proved, and they provide the rational inference of innocence. The split lip, Your Honor, I would just like to note there's other problems with it than the statutory definition. What is undisputed also, and is in the circumstances proved, is that the injury itself, including the internal, the frenulum injury, predated January 2nd. Mom says she saw it happen, that they knew it was there. They were treating it. It reopened when Mr. Schwendeman tapped his lips one time. So I would dispute that anything Mr. Schwendeman did, which again, we're still speculating at this point on appeal, caused, it has to cause the injury. I would suggest that if the injury pre-existed, he didn't cause it that day. And I just want to note, it's troubling that we have been through a jury trial, we have a verdict, and the representative of the state is still saying he could have done X and he could have done Y and he could have done Z. They have to prove what he did because they have to show.
I don't understand that exactly. If a healthy child goes into a room, another adult comes into the room, the adult leaves and the child is grievously injured. Why would the state have to prove precisely whether it was a kick, a hit, a strangulation, et cetera, if the evidence, assuming in that case that the evidence proves that the injury was a result of a physical assault on the child? I don't really understand that argument.
Well, they've got to prove every element of the offense. So this is not an assault. And we should be mindful of the fact that the jury-
So in the circumstance that I suggested, the state could not prove malicious punishment of a child in the circumstances?
So just showing that a child is injured does not satisfy malicious punishment because it has
so
to be-
So showing a child was injured when alone with a parent and the time frame. I mean, that's what I'm just trying to set up. I understand that you disagree with some of those things with respect to this case, but that seems like circumstantial evidence would rule out any rational inference other than that the person injured them.
So perhaps in your hypothetical, the state satisfactorily proved malicious punishment, but that is not what happened here. This child is not healthy. This child has a rare condition And nothing in the evidence disproves the rationable hypothesis that he lost consciousness due to that condition. Also, we have no acute injuries. There's nothing the state or that their witnesses could point to say that there was contact between Mr. Schwendemann and Elijah on January 2nd, which is the only date that matters. I also just briefly want to point out, there is no head trauma. There's no head injury in this case. Respondent's brief and perhaps argument suggested that there was. Elijah's head CT was normal. There was no bleeding in his brain. The cases that respondent relied on are dramatically different than this case, because in Stewart and in Murray, they said the other potential causes were physically impossible. The court used that word, impossible. That's not true here. So I believe in Stewart, someone suggested the child banged his head on the floor. That's not what the sort of rational hypothesis is being presented here. It's that he had an internal cause that we know was established beyond a doubt by a medical expert that presents that rational inference. So even if in most cases, when there's an adult in a room with a child and that child ends up injured, the state could satisfactorily prove their charge, which again is malicious punishment, has very particular elements. It doesn't in this case, because this case is highly unusual and different than the norm.
Okay. Your time is up, but let me ask the panel if they have any more questions before we end. Well, thank you both very much for your helpful arguments and briefing. We will take the matter under advisement, and a decision will be issued within the statutory time period. Thank you so much.